All right, good morning. Welcome back. This is the I Am Sorry About Last Night podcast, part of the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Local folks doing local podcasts. Good morning. December the 21st, 2022, 4 days before Christmas. I know we're all super excited. Beautiful day here on the East Coast. Chilly, you know, clear, sunny, but cold. Which is exactly where we're supposed to be, I would imagine. But they're calling for some cold stuff on Saturday. I think we're going to be in that, I don't know if it's El Nino or El Nina, but it's going to be one of those years where we are always on the rain side. And that's a big prediction, I know. But that is me not staying in the day. But it's funny, where I live, or where we live at least, is... you know, it's like if it's an El Nino year, we get a lot of snow. If it's an El Nina, we get a lot of rain. And it, so far, it appears like we're going to be on the rainy side of some of these big storms. I know there's a big storm coming through, but they're giving us all rain. Everybody up north getting snow. Who cares? Whatever. I do like snow. It brings a lot of drama. The career that I used to be in, working on the golf course, snow was a big deal. Today in the hair business, not so much. I just need to make sure that I can get to the shop and people can get to the front door. But, you know, I like snow. It would be fun. I know my wife would love to have some snow for Christmas. I don't think that that is going to happen. But anyway, so I thought I would sit down. I hadn't done a podcast in a while. I struggle a little bit now with this podcast because I feel like I've talked about everything. And, but I like to try, you know, I'll sit down and go, I think I'm done with this podcast. And I'm like, well, but I enjoy it. So I'll do what I can. I know tomorrow is my anniversary, 14 years of sobriety. And that is tomorrow, December the 22nd. Very excited about that. But not that excited, right? I mean, it's great. I am very grateful to be sober for that long. I thought maybe I would just share some of my story this morning, and I'm going to probably do a couple podcasts next few days and just kind of celebrate my anniversary with, you know, sharing about how, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, right? If you're ever going to, if anybody ever asks you to sit up front, those are, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, which I always think is interesting because they're that middle one, right? What happened? You know, there are people out there that didn't have a what happened. Just decided one day to get sober. I think that's great. I'm not always absolutely sure that that's true. Not sure we're all being honest, but doesn't matter. I know for me, there was how it was. There was definitely a what happened. I have several what happens, and there is how it is today. But I just thought I would go back. You know, when I shared, it's probably been a month now. I shared at a Friday night meeting, and same sort of format. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But I sort of basically started off of March 31st, 1997. March 31st, 1997 is where I initially made my first leap into sobriety. And I had been up until that point, you know, I look back at my life up until that point, and, you know, when I look back at it today, it was pretty rough. At the time, you know, I had no idea there was a better life. You know, I was drinking every day. I've shared multiple times about, you know, my ritual in those back in those days, which was, you know, basically come to, right? I think we all have experienced that. But coming to, I used to wake up every morning drunk. Every morning I would wake up drunk or at least affected. You know, I could walk, I could, you know, do what I had to do, but I always had that little the fog. But I would wake up every morning, you know, drunk and full of shame, a heavy heart, a lot of guilt, embarrassment, disappointment. You know, every morning I'd be like, God, what am I doing? You know, because I was living at the point of my life, it was just a grind. And I'm sure, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you've struggled with alcohol or any other substances, you know the grind. And, you know, I would wake up and, you know, go get a coffee and go to work and just bouncing along the bottom. It was really, you know, and at the time I was, if I look back at the moment, I was, felt like I was doing really well. I'm struggling with an addiction, but I'm showing up for work. I know the guy that I was then, I was always looking for things to tell me that you're not as bad as you think you are. And as long as I could get to work, I wasn't as bad as I thought I was. Now, if I had lost my job, then clearly I'm a shithead. But if I'm working, right? I still got a car and I still have a house or a little apartment. But these were all things that I would say, hey, you're not so bad. You got these things. But I honestly, now when I sit here and talk about it, I had no idea that my life could be as great as it is, right? I don't think that I realized the person that I was back then, drinking and just basically giving up to this addiction. You know, I had really lost all value. I wasn't valuable to anybody. And I sort of had lost all hope. But I tell you what, March 31st, 1997, I found a glimmer of hope. No value to anybody, complete waste of space. And when I had that opportunity, and I took it, you know, went out just like every other night, you know, got off work, probably drank some beers, you know, and every day it would be like, I'm not drinking, you know, today I'm going to take a break. Not like I needed it. It would appear in my mind as some super responsible decision, like, hey, you know, tonight, why don't we take a break? You know, we had a lot of fun last night. Let's take a break. But the day, and usually that decision was made under the influence of alcohol. Like, you know, being under the influence got me in a lot of shit, but also being under the influence, you know, there was a lot of reasonable thinking at some point. Now, would I follow through with it? More than likely, never. But I would wake up with good intentions. Let's take a break tonight. And I would get to work. And one of the things that I think about, that, you know, one of the hard parts at the time in my life was just this constant anxiety, just this weight, this blanket that was just constantly on me, whether it was, you know, what was going to be the next thing that was going to happen to me, because something was always going to happen to me. If you drink a bottle of vodka every night, something's going to happen, whether it's going to be stitches, a broken car, a broken window, an altercation with a neighbor, getting your ass kicked at a bar, whatever it is, but something was going to happen. I knew it. Everybody knows it. And so that constant wet blanket of anxiety that was constantly over me, you know, so I would wake up with just in this pit in my stomach and, you know, I'd get to work. And unfortunately for me, that job, there was a lot of times where you were just alone. You know, I mean, I'd go to work. You know, I worked on a golf course, we'd cut greens or whatever, and then, you know, my lunch assignment would usually be, or after lunch, it'd be like, you know, get on a fairway unit and just start cutting fairways. And, you know, it's a long day grinding on a machine, which unfortunately leaves a lot of time to think. And I would remember driving, you know, these machines, and, you know, other crew members would ride by and they'd sort of laugh or, you know, make, you know, just having fun, point at me, ha ha, you're out on a fairway unit. And I would sit there and I would stew in this fear, guilt, you know, weird place, and just sit there and stew in it. Like, the nobody likes me. They're talking shit about me. Blah, blah, me, blah, blah. And it was just such a fucking horrible existence.
And
the problem was, is that I was deep in my addiction. And, you know, at the time, I just thought I drank too much. But, you know, looking back on it, it was just self. And, you know, it talks about in the book, fear made us like this. Fear made me drink. I never really thought that, but that would be my whole life, fear. What are they saying? Nobody likes me. Am I going to drink again? What bad is going to happen? It was just awful. And looking back at it, you know, today, I just think, my God, what a relief. You know, I woke up this morning, no fear, no heavy blanket, no burden, no shame, no guilt. I woke up this morning, nothing bad happened yesterday, went to bed great, got up this morning, I had to get my hair cut, I was going to do a podcast, I'm off, we're going to go shopping. I mean, it's just, there is no anxiety today. I have no fear. And if I do have fear, it's usually because, you know, I want to be great at what it is I'm doing. So usually my fear is, oh, I'm not going to be good at this. But I've been taught, you know, I've learned, hey, you know, stay in the moment. You might not be good at it, but you're going to try it, you know. I sort of had to change what was important. You know, it's not as much how good or how bad I looked. It's, did I try? Did I push through? Did I ignore that voice? But my God, when I think back on it, just the pain. And so that March 31st, 1997, I went to, you know, I worked all day and then probably went by my parents' house, had a few beers out of my dad's refrigerator, you know, always with the intention of taking a break for the day, right? It was always, I'm going to take a break tonight, or I'm just going to drink beer. The problem is, when I would drink just beer, after I got a few beers on me, then this other voice said, why are we just drinking beer? Let's drink some vodka. Every day this happened. Every day. I'm not going to drink. Maybe I'll just drink beer. Oh, now that I had beer, why don't we have vodka? Once I got a few vodkas in me, God only knows, because I also would be like, you're not drinking and driving tonight. Because I was a drunk driver. You're not drinking and driving tonight. We're going to stay home. We'll order some food. We'll just stay home. We'll be a good boy. Never happened. Started drinking beer. Then I got the vodka. Then I'm out driving. Drugs would show up. God only knows. It was just a fucking horrible existence. And then I would wake up the next day and it would start all over. But on March 31st, you know, probably decided to get some vodka. Then I had the great idea to go down to the bar, which was, I would say, 300 yards from my house, which I would drive to. I would drive, drink and drive down to the stupid bar that's not even that far, go down to the bar, playing some pool, getting loud, getting louder, getting louder, and then last call would come, which is what happened that night, and I would just, there, you couldn't give me enough beers at last call or vodkas. You know, it's like, give me two, it's last call. I'm fucking hammered, and I want two more. But just like, I need to. And the guy said, yeah, I'll get it. Hold on. And then he came back. He goes, oh, sorry, time's out. None for you. I know he did it on purpose. And as a guy that's sober today, and if I was dealing with somebody like that, I would be the same way. Oh, sorry, dude. None for you. And I fucking ran my big mouth, spewing my toxic nonsense, and got punched. I still, to this day, do not know what hit me, but whatever it was a good one because it split my lip. I fell to the floor, and I've shared this before, man. I was on all fours, like some sort of yoga move, and just watching the blood pour out of my mouth down on this hard wooden floor. I bet the blood stain's still there on that bar floor. And looking over at the bartender and thinking, because he had to walk around the bar, coming back towards me, and thinking, oh, man, this guy's going to help me out. He's my friend. And he picked me up, and he threw me out the front door. And that would be really the beginning of me trying to get sober. And I had in the past, I'd been to so many meetings. My grandmother was big into AA here on the East Coast. She was, she knew all about it. And so I'd always had that, that rumblings of maybe a meeting. Recovery was always discussed in our household. We've always gone to, I've gone to psychiatrists, psychologists all my life. I have to always tell, my parents, they tried, right? They tried to figure us out. I think a big part of that was being adopted. I know I've talked about it. I don't carry this I was adopted burden on my back. I don't feel like it. I stress more because I didn't really do well in school. That bothers me more than being adopted. But maybe being adopted, when I look at it now and I think about it, it is a trippy thing, to be given away. There is something, I think, by the relationship that we have with our real mother and father. I mean, my parents are fantastic, and I never want to make them seem like they're not. I think the job they had was a tough one. But the point is that, they've always taken us to psychiatrists and counseling and trying to figure out what our problem is. And, I don't know what it was, but for some reason, I just have had this struggle in my life. And it was always easy for me to hang out with the people doing the bad stuff, the drinking and the partying. And so trying to figure this out has been a lifelong process for our family. So, the discussion of recovery or trying to get sober or stop smoking pot or whatever it was always being talked about in my early teens. So on this night, something was different, and I think what it was is just that, and I've talked about it before, I have a higher power and I have a lower power. And I call, lower power, ego, pride, self, all that shit. That to me is, that's the devil. And back in those days, I was under the influence of the devil, right? My lower power, my ego. And that moment when I got my ass punched and beat up, my ego was humiliated. Ego devastation, complete humiliation. And when that happens, and it's happened to all of us, that's what happened. That's the what it was like, what happened, and what it's like to now. What it's like now. There for me, and I listen. If you were a big drinker and woke up and had a dream that you needed to get sober, and you just got sober, good for you. But I don't believe that. I think it takes ego to be devastated, humiliated, and like Anthony Kiedis said, that freaking window opened a little bit, and And I've shared this before, and, early on I thought, oh, I got my ass kicked, I need to get sober. But, looking back on it, the story has evolved a little more. And the reality was is that I got my ass kicked, and I was so embarrassed and ashamed by my condition that I had to figure out how not to go to work. And I remember I had called my friend Linda, who's since passed on, unfortunately, byproduct of this hard living. But I called her. She took me to the hospital. Dr. Angel sewed me up. And there was a nurse, and she said, do you think you have an alcohol problem? And I said, I do. Now, granted, my life was constantly thinking about how not to drink or to drink. That was my life. It was either I'm going to get drunk or I can't believe I got drunk. I never lived in this just peaceful place. Alcohol, either doing it or not doing it, was all part of my world at that time. And this lady's like, I remember going to my regular doctor and telling him, I'm depressed. And he asked me, how much do you drink? And I said, maybe a beer or two. I was drinking a bottle of vodka every night. But he's like, well, if you're not drinking that much and you're feeling depressed, I can put you on something. He put me on an antidepressant. I was still depressed because the fact is I was a drunk. I was sad and I wasn't honest. So when that nurse said, hey, do you think you have a drinking problem? I said, I do. And she said, do you want to try to get some help? And I said, I would. And she, you know, sat with me for a minute and shared that there was a program at the fifth floor of the hospital, and it was an outpatient, intense outpatient. You didn't live there. I was in the hospital for 5 days because of my stitches and just, you know, my condition, which was just a guy that had been treating himself so badly. So I was in there for a few days, but she said, do you think you have a problem? I said, I do. And so she hooked me up with this lady who ran the outpatient program there at BB. And, but you know, the whole time thinking, yes, I wanted to get sober. Really? I just wanted to not face my coworkers. And I, you know, that took years to figure out. I still think that was fine. You know, I don't know what the fuck I was doing. You just go with it. You know, if you get an opportunity, go with it. If your motivation's good or bad, who cares? Just go with it. That's why I say, just go to a meeting, right? Let's go. But, you know, I would get into this program and just, it would be the beginning of a real change in my life. And so, you know, doing that for a year, which meant I had a meeting. I went to that group probably every Thursday or something. But I was going to a lot of meetings, and it was just amazing because, you know, I had moved to Delaware from California, and in California I was really pretty bad. I mean, we were doing a lot of drugs, meth, a lot of drinking the whole time. But, you know, whatever drugs we could get our hands on, we were doing them. And I was selling them. I was running the streets. I was running the game. And just living that life of really a possessed person. Because that guy doesn't exist today. So that's why I like to say I feel like I was possessed by the devil at that period of my life. Because I probably didn't talk the same. I didn't walk the same. My behaviors were completely different. It was just a different kind of person. That person was always about getting what he wanted, getting drunk, getting drugs, making money, you know, hooking up with chicks. It was fun. Listen, I had no desire to get sober back then. I was having a lot of fun. But, you know, the story would continue and the grind would continue. And so when I first came into this program, into the outpatient program, that was really the beginning of being around people doing something other than the life that I had been living for so long, which was just running the streets. And it was about, you know, going to meetings and just learning to be a different person, a better person, really learning to be the person that I think that I always wanted to be. You know, it didn't take a lot of effort to be a nice person. I wasn't so far gone that I was just mean and nasty. I think when I got that alcohol and drugs out of my system and I got a few days sober, it felt good, right? I was like, oh, my God. I shared the other day, man, I'll never forget driving home from my first meeting not drunk. I mean, I was a drunk driver. And as soon as I put down the freaking the alcohol and drugs, I became more valuable as a person. My buddy Matt used to say, as soon as you pick up a drink, all bets are off. As long as you're not drinking and drugging, nothing can stop you. People could say, oh, well, you're maybe not that educated, or maybe you don't have enough experience, but you can say, hey, I can work hard at it. I can study. I can show up every day early. I can get the experience. I can do whatever it is I want to do. But as soon as I put a drink in me, they're right. You can't do this. You can't do that because you drink. And I would always be like, oh, my God, you know. So my value started to increase. I could start to feel just how I felt about myself. My persona began to improve because, yeah, I may not be the smartest guy. I may not be the richest guy, but I am not a drunk and I'm not on drugs. And so right away I felt like my value went up, and it was awesome. But just getting into that routine of doing meetings and, you know, shaking people's hands and taking on commitments. And then I remember graduating from that outpatient program, and my parents came, and it was in this little room, and it was just a couple of us graduating, but I was just so freaking proud. I don't know if I spoke. I must have spoke. But I was just so proud of the fact that I had gone almost, I guess it was a year program, so I'd gone a year, and then my first anniversary was relatively somewhere near there, the sitting up front and speaking. But my God, it was just such an improvement in my life. And but you know, so I'm just sharing from March 31st. So you know what it was like. You know, wide eyed, super excited about this new beginning for me. This, you know, for some reason in the first few days I had lost that desire to drink. It is a miracle because the day, you know, a few days before I couldn't stop drinking. A few days later, I literally have no desire to drink. But I'm also deep into this, you know, outpatient program and at the same time going to a lot of meetings. I mean, I did 120 meetings in 90 days. So I'm doing everything. And when you're in that lifestyle, yeah, you do not feel like drinking. But what happened? So that's what it was like. What happened? Because I did eventually drink again. And so what it was like is after the outpatient program, I'm involved with the group. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I'm making meetings. I got a men's group. We're taking meetings into jails, institutions. I'm deep into it, and I'm loving it. But what happened is that I just didn't realize the importance of the steps. And I just didn't understand really who I was. You know, I would later learn I'm a people pleaser. I want to look better than I am. And so initially doing the first time going through the steps, it was more about get them done. Somebody's giving me a task in this program. I want to get it done so that I appear to them like I am on top of it. And so, you know, burning quickly through the steps, not really doing a great fourth and fifth step. But I didn't understand. I mean, I had no idea. And so sort of being on a shaky ground. And then a few years later, still sober, still feeling good. The other thing that was a problem, and I didn't realize it, or I ignored it, was that in 1999, so I got sober in 97. 99, I pulled my back deadlifting. And I was prescribed pain pills. I had a bad back injury. I mean, I literally had to be wheelchaired into the ER by my father. I had to crawl from my house into the car because my back had been, I had strained my disc so bad. And so I'll never forget going to the ER, and they gave me oxycodone. And I was in this euphoric place. I remember my eyes were closed, and I was opiumed up. And I think they gave me a prescription of those, and then I went home, and I took them, and then I got them refilled, and I think they started putting me on, like, Percocet or Vicodin or something like that, and just this insane chase for that high would start. And I always just thought I was just had a back injury. So in 99, with that back injury, I started doing, I was, during the incident, when I pulled my back, I was on pain pills, and that was probably fine, but like every few weeks, my back would it would come back and it would be really bad. And I would call it in and they would call in a prescription and I would take these pain pills and I was binging on them. I didn't realize it. I just thought I was taking them because of the pain, but I was abusing them. And so that was in 99. So right now, so from 97 to 99, that's the cleanest and the most sober I had ever been. And then these pain pills showed up. And so I started doing pain pills in my first 5 years of recovery, thinking that it was okay because it was an injury and they were prescribed. No, they're not. It was completely undermining my serenity, and it would come back to get me because this would go on. I remember finally moving out to Easton in 99 to take on a new job and hooking up with a doctor out there and, you know, binging on these pain pills. It wasn't every week. But every 4 or 5 weeks, I would call. I had a blown out disc. So they would give me the pain pills, they'd give me the muscle relaxers. And that would be really, I think, I don't know if it was the straw that broke the camel's back, but it wasn't good. And so finally being out in over in Easton, Maryland, and I've shared this before, you know, going to the meetings out there, and I didn't like the way they collected the money. But this would be, you know, looking back on it, this would really expose this real battle that I have with a higher power and a lower power. I always was so fascinated by a higher power, a spiritual awakening. You know, that's all that everybody talks about, this higher power and the spiritual awakening, and it's really great. But you know, I had a real relationship with a lower power, and I didn't know how to break up with this lower power. I didn't know how to identify when I would have a relationship with the lower power. I never realized the voices that would come in with this lower power that would talk me out of shit. And that voice was like, you know, we don't like the way that they collect the money. We don't like the way the door's facing. It was whatever. And the next thing you know, those voices would separate me from going to meetings at all. So eventually, I'm like 4 years into sobriety. I think I'm doing great, but I'm full of shit. I'm, you know, going to meetings and claiming to be sober, but taking pain pills because I were prescribed. And then I didn't like the way the meetings were run. So 4.5 years into it, the next thing you know, a voice is like, you know, look how good you've done. We should try drinking. And I had no support. I had no support. And plus, I was a little bummed out that I had moved over to Easton because I had to take a job over there. But all of my friends and my program people were all over in Rehoboth here. So, you know, I was a little bit in mourning. But, you know, that lower power took advantage of that opportunity. And the next thing you know, it's like, why don't you have a discussion with your wife and see if we can start drinking again? And I did. And I asked her. I started drinking again is what I did. And then I'm like, well, shit. So I had a conversation. I'm like, listen, I think I'm, you know, it's been 5 years and I think I can try drinking again. And she's like, well, that's, if you think so. I mean, she had no idea what a bad idea that was. I mean, anybody, like if somebody came up to me today and said, listen, I think I could start drinking, I would be like, that is the fucking worst idea. But she was like, maybe, I guess, I don't know anything about this. So it's been 5 years. And I, you know, of course I negotiated a deal where I would only have a couple, right? Or a few. I think it was like three. Well, if I just have a few beers, you know, what's the big deal? And she's like, yeah, I mean, really, what is the big deal? I'm like, vodka was my problem. But man, I took that first drink and the fucking vodka and the beers came a flowing and it was a nightmare. I was drinking a bottle of vodka every night. It was like I had never stopped. And we hear that in the program. People say that addiction just keeps on getting on, you know, doing push-ups in the corner, getting stronger and stronger. Even though you're not drinking, the addiction still gets stronger. And they are right, because when I picked up, man, it was off to the races again. And I remember, you know, this three-beer deal. And what a terrible thing that is, you know, that I had put my wife through at the time. Because, you know, I would say, yeah. But I would drink like a bottle of vodka before she would get home. And then I'd be almost drunk, and then she would show up, and then I'd be like, all right, I'm gonna have my three beers. And they were like these big IPAs, just the biggest, biggest beers. And then I'd be like, you know, maybe can I have a fourth tonight? You know, just tonight. It was like, the poor lady, I feel so bad. And that would be, you know, a real struggle for the next couple of years between that. And then, you know, I think we had a big fight, and I'd be like, you know, I'm going to quit, and I couldn't quit. And so I would be a few weeks of lying, which would be sneaking vodka, drinking, her just drinking to a point where she wouldn't realize and getting away with it, but all the whole time acting like I'm sober, probably still going to meetings. I don't even know. And then eventually I would drink, you know, one night I would drink too much, and then she'd be like, have you been drinking? I'm like, oh, I screwed up. I'm so sorry. Just one time I screwed up. When I'd been drinking every night, it was just a fucking pack of lies and a real nightmare. And finally trying to get sober again and picking up and just bouncing in and out. And then finally we moved back over to Rehoboth and to start a landscaping business. And I was drinking. I was taking Vicodin, and I was drinking. I remember taking like 6 Vicodin, throwing up in a bucket, picking the Vicodin out of my puke, taking them again, just smoking cigars and cigarettes and drinking Mike's lemonade. And oh, it was just disgusting. It was disgusting. And I remember this finally walking in. My wife and I were still married. We'd moved into our house over here in Rehoboth. And coming home, I'd gone to this lighting show up in, I don't know, Bear, Delaware, and decided I would stop at a Ruby Tuesdays for one drink, right, and just fucking got hammered, and finally come home, and I'm drunk, and I don't remember the night. I'm sure I ran my mouth, but woke up the next morning to an empty house. And, you know, that wasn't even the bottom. My addiction was like, sweet. Now nobody can stop us. Nobody is between you and drinking. And I would drink a little longer. And then finally, you know, partying one night, and I finally had had enough, and would run up to call my buddy. He came, drove 4 hours, picked me up, drove me up to the Colonial House up in Pennsylvania, where I'd spend 9 days, and I came back, and I was ready. I was ready, and the window had been opened up again. This time it didn't take a lot of humiliation. It just, I was so beaten down, the window just fell open. The window couldn't stay closed anymore. I was like, there was really no... I had lost all hope, and my son had just been born. No, my son had just celebrated his first birthday. He was one. I remember taking him up to try to buy birthday presents for him to make the pain in my heart go away, and it wasn't going away, and that's when I made the phone call. But we'd come back, and that's when I met my buddy Matt, or actually asked him to be my sponsor. We had been friends since 98. And he said, yeah, call me every day and we'll see what happens. And that would be the beginning of a great relationship. But it would be a couple years into that run where I would eventually have to address the pain pills. Because if you have a back injury like I have, it's always hurting. I mean, there's always pain. But I tell you what, when I would take those pain pills, the pain would get worse, right? It would like, oh, we need more of these. We are in more pain. And... got myself in some jam up, and I remember telling Matt, I go, you know, I've been taking pain pills. And he goes, well, you can't take pain pills. And I'm like, well, I have a back issue. And he goes, well, yeah, well, you know, Advil or Motrin or something like that, but, you know, you can't be taking these pain pills. And you're going to actually have to change your sobriety date. And I was like, oh, my God. And this is 2 years. So I had almost had 5 years, fell off the wagon, and then... had almost 2 years again. And he said, you're going to have to change your sobriety date because of these pain pills. And I was like, oh, my God. He goes, if you don't, you're never going to get sober. And I was like, oh. So I changed them. And that was in 08, December 22nd, 2008. And that would be... So my last... I mean, honestly, I haven't had a drink in 16 years. And honestly, I probably could have... stopped doing the pain pills and just carried on with that sobriety date. But it would have always had an asterisk in my mind, right? But, you know, listen, I can eat too much food and feel like I've gone off the wagon. So, you know, I guess it is what it is. But he made it seem very important that I change that date, and I did. And so 14 years later, and believe me, it's weird that it's been 14 years. But I know I haven't had a drink or drug since that day, and my son is going to be 18. And it's just, you know, time flies, I guess, when you're having fun. And so, you know, tomorrow I will celebrate 14 years, and I'm super proud of that. And, you know, people ask me, you know, how do you get 14 years? And, you know, it's always one day at a time. But, you know, I have surrendered to everything. Right, I'm basically given up. I have three things I do. I have my family. Well, really, I have my sobriety, I have my family, and I have my work. Those are it. Those are my three things. Sobriety, family, work. And I, as a person who will celebrate 14 years, I go to 3 to 4 meetings a week. And before the pandemic, I was probably, you know, 3 to 4 meetings a week. During the pandemic, I didn't go to one meeting. I didn't go to one Zoom meeting. I didn't do anything. But I still had, you know, I was running with my buddy James, who's sober. I still had, you know, contact with people in the program, but I was not going to any meetings. And it feels like it's only been about a year, or half a year, 8 months, that meetings really have started getting to be open and being able to go back to them on a regular basis. And it's felt good. And as a guy that's got this much time, which isn't that much, right? My buddy James, he's got over 30. I'd have almost 30 if I'd have stuck with it, but I didn't. And time isn't important. Quality is. And but, you know, today, you know, I have the most important thing I do in my life is this program. three or four meetings a week. You know, I went to a meeting on Monday. I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I'll be at a meeting tonight. I'm running the meeting on Friday. You know, three or four meetings a week. That's what I have to do. Not because, because I always hear something new. I always hear something fresh. And the reality is that there's a lot of people that come into this program and they need some people with some time. And so being there for the next person is very important. But three or four meetings a week, I will have to go to three or four meetings a week for the rest of my life. I've surrendered the idea that is any different. That's the way it is. I've surrendered the idea that I will become some sort of normal person that doesn't need this program anymore. That's never happening. I am stricken with a disease that is never cured. I just have a daily reprieve. And so meetings. If you aren't going to a lot of meetings, you're probably headed towards a drink. You know it, and I know it. You definitely know it. If you are a bad alcoholic like I was, you need three or four meetings a week. It's just the reality, right? People say, well, I didn't get better to go to meetings all the time. Yeah, you did. That's it. That's your only hope. And the problem is people can't follow that direction, so that's why not many people stay sober. I can tell you the crowd of people that I knew March 31st, 1997, to the crowd, the same crowd today, there's probably a handful of people that I remember that were sober back then, that are still sober. Many have died. You know, we had a lot. One of the cool things when I got sober is we had a lot of great old timers. And I'd be like, oh, these guys are a pain in the ass. I mean, really get with it. But the fact is, you know, old timers are important, man, because principles over personalities. And unfortunately, personalities show up. And it's great when we have old timers around to say, hey, check your personality. Because personalities will ruin the shit. And like I've said, you know, I've been to bagel meetings, pillow meetings, beach meetings, sunrise meetings, sunset meetings, you know, hundreds of personality meetings. And I appreciate them. I love every meeting, but, you know, it's important, you know, and now we don't have as many old timers and it feels a little like more personalities than principles, but it'll work itself out. It always does. But just super grateful to be sober and for today. And let me just see if I can read a little daily reflections. I'm going to probably chat a little bit more about my anniversary if I can. I'm not going to make a big deal about it, but I should share because I know there's a lot of people out there, newcomers coming in and, you know, it's important that some people with some time are still hanging in there because it's not easy getting sober. It's not easy. It's not easy getting sober a few times. Let's see, daily reflections. Listen, share, and pray. Here we go. December 21st. When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do. Good point. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 100. When trying to help a fellow alcoholic, I've given in to an impulse to give advice. And perhaps that's inevitable. But allowing others the right to be wrong reaps its own benefits. The best I can do, and it sounds easier than it is, to put into practice is to listen, share personal experience, and pray for others. Yeah. That's exactly why it's important that people with time hang in there because all we can do is share our experience. You know, sitting down and doing this podcast, I've never tried to be a person to tell a person what to do. I have no idea, right? I'm not an expert in this, but I can share my experience. And luckily I have a lot of it and it's been pretty awesome. But listen, if you're new to the program or you're new to trying to get any sober and you're not using a program, whatever it is you're doing, just hang in there. You know, hopefully you're using a program. I love this program. I went with a friend to an Al-Anon meeting on Monday because, you know, there's things going on in this person's life that are a little rough. And I said, I was lucky enough, unfortunately, had to be an alcoholic to be able to look and use these steps in my life. But there is another way, and it's through Al-Anon. And Al-Anon uses the same 12 steps as AA. And, you know, because, my God, it's just to be able to use, you know, these the gifts that are in this program in our daily lives is just so awesome, right? It just brings such a simple day. And I was hoping that maybe he could get some of that from that program. We'll see. Yeah, very lucky. Anyway, I hope everyone's having a great day, and we'll catch you later. Bye.